From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Jonathan Johnson, the chairman of Overstock.com, took a gamble earlier this year. He's a Republican, and he wants to replace fellow Republican Gary Herbert for the governorship. Now, this is a problem because Herbert is a very popular governor among Republican voters. So Johnson's strategy was to sort of bypass those voters and appeal directly to state party delegates at the party convention. These are delegates who tend to be more conservative than the governor. And the strategy kind of worked. He forced Herbert into a primary race. Now, the question for today's show is there something wrong with this system where you have people who tend to be more conservative or more liberal picking the candidates that mainstream Utahns and Americans will vote for later? Join us after the news.
Hey, I'm Elaine Clark, one of the producers for Radio West, inviting you to check out Video West. It's our online showcase of short documentaries about the places and people that make Utah what it is. You can stream the films at videowest.kuer.org, and if you like what you see and hear, we hope you'll share it with your friends. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You've got to hand it to them. The political activists in this country who get involved in the electoral process. These are the people early on who make placards and wear goofy hats and go to rallies and who show up at party caucuses and primaries early in the process, long before most of the rest of the country begins to really pay attention. But the problem with this system, some say anyway, is that those active and engaged people don't necessarily share the same positions as mainstream voters. They're more passionate and often, it's argued, more extreme. So critics of this system say what happens is you get a candidate who's not only more conservative or more liberal than the majority, but they're accountable to fewer people and less inclined to compromise. So today in the program, we're talking about this system. Is it healthy and democratic or lopsided and leaving lots of people without a say? Joining us today in the program to talk about it, James Evans is with us. He's chairman of the Utah Republican Party, has served as a state senator from District 1 and as chair of the Salt Lake County GOP. And Chairman Evans, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
And now the current chair of the Utah Republican Party.
Yes, indeed. Did I not say that? That's
no.
What I started. Kirk Jowers is a founder and board member of Count My Vote. It's a group aimed at challenging the Utah caucus system. He was chairman and general counsel of Mitt Romney's leadership PAC, chair of Governor John Huntsman's Commission on Strengthening Utah's Democracy. He's joining us here in the studio, and welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Doug.
I want to begin with this question of how we got here to this system. This is something that, Kirk Jowers, you've spent some time about, so I want to get your perspective, and Chairman Evans, I want to get you to respond. How did we get to the point where you thought you wanted to change the system, something that motivated you to want to initiate something like Count My Vote? Like, what were you seeing?
It hit me in 2006. I moved back to Utah from Washington, D.C. in 2005 to take over the Hinckley Institute and do some other things at the University of Utah. And after the 2006 election, I was shocked to see Utah at the near the bottom, I think 47th in the country, in voter participation. When I had left in the 80s, Utah was always seen as one of the top voting states. And so it just kind of hit me. And of course, Hinckley Institute is all about voter participation. So I kind of looked into it and was kind of shocked to realize that Utah was the only state in the nation that had this very restrictive caucus convention system. There were a few other states, five, that had caucus convention, but they had alternate paths to the ballot. And so they did have primary elections. Utah really didn't have primary elections.
There's one path.
There's one path, and it's through 4,000 people for Republicans and 2,700 for Democrats statewide. When you get to House, you're talking about a couple of handfuls.
Yeah.
And there was no attention given to the public. So my initial op-ed on it was much more modest than what it became, which was simply we should go back at least to what Utah's founding fathers put in. This is a system from the 1890s, and at that point, a challenger only needed to get 20% to make the primary ballot. Each party had taken their turn, taking it from 80 to 70 to 60 to make it more difficult for anyone to run for office. So I said, let's at least go back to what our founders said. The other thing was Utah's system was seen as the most ripe for corruption. Indeed, I had witnessed that. You walk in, even today, you walk in to these neighborhood caucuses. It's not very well policed on who can be in there and who can vote, even at the convention. This year, there were all sorts of issues with people voting where they shouldn't and revotes and on and on. So I thought, let's get rid of corruption. Let's get more people involved. And then it's evolved from 2006.
Chairman, how do you respond to that? Kirk Jower sees a system and he sees it as problematic. Only one path. What's practical or political in terms of being an advantage the way you're seeing that system?
Well, before I can even begin, I have to respond to all the misinformation. I mean, this is just, you know, this is just so astounding. Let's start from the very beginning.
Okay.
First of all, in the caucus convention system, anyone can participate. Anyone can show up. Everything is out in the open. So what we are up against, and when we start talking about small numbers of people, under the Count My Vote model, it's less than 20 people who will pre-select candidates for the primary because it's based on money. And it's only a few people who have a lot of money.
We're going to get to that, Chairman, I promise.
But you must understand, when you start hearing accusations about corruption and a few people, let's really look at what happened under Count My Vote and the true motivations behind it. It's very simple. This came down to one concern that Kirk Jowers and a few others had. There were not enough moderate Republicans getting elected.
Right.
As a Republican
party. What's wrong
party,
with that, though?
This is my answer.
Yeah.
As a Republican Party chair, let me let you in on a little secret. We don't care if you're a liberal Republican, moderate Republican, conservative Republican. That's not our role. Our role is just to make sure that if you are a Republican candidate, that you have some relationship with the party's platform. The thing that I find most disappointing in this entire process has been somehow the political parties are at fault for wanting to make sure that those who run under their banner actually have a relationship with the principles or the foundational principles of that organization. So it's just a bizarre set of circumstances where you have very powerful individuals, albeit a few of them, that are able to advance a narrative that has no relationship to what political parties do. We are the Republican Party. There is a Democrat Party, a Libertarian Party. And so you would be hard-pressed to find any political party that would say, hey, if you're going to at least have some relationship to what we organize ourselves around, our platform, our principles, that's all we're asking. But you have others, and Count My Vote is a special interest. You must separate the two, special interest versus a political party. A special interest means they have a specific agenda that they want to drive through. The Utah Republican Party in particular did not fall in line. So I guess they said, if we cannot change your mind, we would simply change the rules.
What's the difference between the Republicans who show up early in the process, those 4,000 that Kirk Jowers just mentioned, and the Republicans who vote in November, who don't go to rallies or caucuses, just do their own research on a candidate, go to the polls in November? Is there a difference in terms of ID? Because I think that is the argument, that most Republicans are more moderate than those who show up early in the process.
See,
do you see a difference between those two subsections?
You're falling victim to the same propaganda. Political parties.
No, I'm not. I'm not. I'm asking a question.
No,
what's
because
the
premise
The premise of the question is this, Mr. Chairman. Is there a difference, do you think, between the delegates in terms of their ideology and mainstream voters
this
who show up in November?
This is the point you have to, if you allow me to answer the question.
I will. I just want to clarify the question.
Well, you need to clarify the circumstances. You will always have vetting of candidates. That's what political parties do.
Right.
Under Count My Vote, you go from 4,000 state delegates vetting a statewide candidate to less than 20 people in Count My Vote that would do the vetting based on who they're going to give their money to.
Yeah.
So the question really is, now if you want to start talking about numbers, do you want 4,000 regular Utahns from all across the state making that decision, or do you want less than 20 people who are not accountable to anyone? By the way, where are the minutes? How do they decide who they're going to give their money to?
Fine, we're but you're not answering the question.
But no, because I will answer it as long as you understand. As long as you understand the context.
I do, and you've said that a number of times, and we can talk about
because
the count
that's
my
most
vote
important.
As being
great. That's most important.
Well, let's stipulate that. The count my vote is a special interest, stipulated. We agree. Let's agree.
Yeah, with less than 20 people who will decide.
Fine. Now,
will decide who the candidates are.
Fine. And fine. But what's the question? But answer the question.
I will answer it as long as you understand. And here's the thing: you can ask whatever you want. I'm going to answer my questions and make sure my points get out.
Absolutely.
And that's what you have to. And that's what we have not had the opportunity to do when you have very powerful people like Kirk Jowers and very wealthy individuals who have been able to shape this narrative. So I want your audience to answer just to think about one thing very simply, that if you have less than 20 people who will pre-select your candidates that you will vote on in the primary, does your vote really count?
Okay, great.
Now,
great. Back to the question.
In any organization, you're going to have the people that are most involved are going to either skew a little bit one way or the other than the general elected because they're more passionate about specific issues.
Right.
So my answer to that is look at the product that the caucus convention system has delivered. I ask you to identify any elected officials in our system that are Republican that you would say should not be in public office. And that's my answer to that. Look at all of those and look at the great work that our Republican elected officials have accomplished, the accolades. That's all a direct result of the caucus convention system. So the bottom line is, does it really matter that the delegates are a little bit more conservative on the Republican side, a little bit more liberal on the Democrat side? Look at who they end up nominating, who end up getting elected, and look at how those individuals have governed. And so that is, to me,
a very important
thing. Can I
mention a few names? Olene Walker, 81% approval, didn't make it out of caucus. Bob Bennett, according to one poll conducted just 2 weeks before the 2010 caucus, he was ahead of Mike Lee 32-12. That is 20 points ahead. Among delegates, though, they liked Mr. Lee, 31-22 over Mr. Bennett. 41% of Republican delegates said they wouldn't vote for Bob Bennett. So you had a difference there between a delegate and a voter. So that
let's correct the record.
Okay.
It was not Mike Lee barely made it out of the convention.
Yeah.
It was who's the one that was 67 votes shy of winning outright with 60%? Tim Bridgewater. And who did Bob Bennett endorse? He endorsed Tim Bridgewater.
Yeah.
So in every opportunity, in those two examples where the delegates displaced the incumbent, they replaced him with someone of the same political stripe. You can't argue that John Huntsman Jr. was any more conservative.
I think there's an argument that Mike Lee is significantly more conservative than Bob Bennett
But
was.
He won it in the primary. He did not win it by the delegates. The delegates went for Tim Bridgewater, and Tim Bridgewater was 67 votes shy of getting. And that's the point I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So when
what's your response to Olene Walker?
Olene Walker was replaced by Nolan Karras and John Huntsman Jr. of the same political stripes. So the delegates did not make the decision based on political ideology.
Okay.
And this is all I'm saying is that at the very least, let's stop this propaganda about somehow you can't make it through the caucus convention system if you happen to be moderate or not moderate. And the delegates have demonstrated they have replaced incumbents with others of the same political stripe.
Okay. But that is your contention, Kirk Jowers. And I want to get you to respond to two things. One is Mr. Evans' principal contention that 22 is worse than 4,000, that under the Count My Vote initiative, you have far fewer people who are making these decisions. They're more party elites. They have higher voter ID. They have more money than a process that's more egalitarian. Yes, it's fewer. It's just the delegates, but it's more fair. How do you respond to that, first of all?
Well, Count My Vote has always been purely about participation. And, he can try to define 20 however he wants as far as major donors to the Republican Party or what have you who have stopped giving. And that's why the party's in such massive debt right now, because they've pursued these court battles. They've lost three times in federal court, once in the Utah Supreme Court, and they keep paying. They keep losing, and they're in debt, and he's upset about that. But there's a solution. You follow The rule of law is passed by a supermajority of Republican delegates and signed by a Republican governor, and as approved by over 80% of the Utah population. So he tries to make us more elite, but us is 80% of the state. It's over. It's an overwhelming majority of self-described conservative Republicans. So it's not just Democrats and independents who have been driving Count My Vote. The other thing is we had over 140,000 signatures to change the system and allow signature gathering to get people on the ballot. So I don't know any definition where it's more elite to allow more people to vote. The fundamental problem with the caucus convention system has nothing to do with ideology or anything else. It is that participation is capped. So no matter how many people go to the neighborhood caucuses, and that's always dwarfed by any primary turnout, you are capped to 4,000 people. And then the even worse thing is it's not at all a democratic republic. In a democratic republic, we would elect Jason Chaffetz, for example, is to be our member of Congress, and he's going to have to vote on these gun laws, and we will know how he voted, and we'll decide whether we want to send him back again. With these delegates, they have no accountability to the people who elected them. So we may have elected someone who we thought would vote for Mike Lee, but they voted for Bob Bennett or vice versa. But they have no accountability. That's not a democratic republic. That's a Soviet system of litmus test and a small inner circle of people who make elections in the dark. And then we as a public have to live. 4,000 is always going to be less than 3 million.
How do you respond to that?
Well, once again, let's go back to what I've been saying, that Count My Vote is an organization where less than 20 individuals will make the determinations. They will pre-select candidates by who they determine they're going to give money to. Now they're asking you to go to the primary.
Am I one of those 20, James? Because I've never been in that meeting.
And then
when do I get to do that?
And then vote on who they have pre-selected by the virtue of who they're going to back financially. So does your vote really count when you have this small group of individuals and some talking about in the dark in some room that decide we're going to back this person, and this person, and then they fund them, and then the public, all they now know is they think these are the candidates because those are the only ones they hear about. So under the Count My Vote system, money will determine who the candidates are, and then by virtue, then they're asking the primary voter to then vote on who we pre-selected. That is Soviet. That is what happened with the Soviet Union. They would just put up puppet candidates, and then the public would just do a cursory vote, but the decision was already made. And the
now, James,
party
I'll give
system,
you, I've got to talk occasionally. Now, my judge said when I diz fail, now, words
and
come
party,
in handy, and
well,
I've seen
I believe
you do
I
this
was
before.
Still, I believe I was still answering. Under
you
the
will
caucus,
for 40 minutes.
under the caucus convention system, anyone can be in leadership. Anyone can become chair of the Utah Republican Party. You just run. I'm still at a loss as to exactly how do you become a leader or have a position of authority or decision-making and Count My Vote. It's just not an open process by which you can participate. And he talks about that it's for everyone. It is not. They're asking the primary voters just to cast a ballot after the small group of people have made decisions. And one last thing regarding the our legal challenge. We followed through with what we said. We litigated. We've gotten an answer from the judge, and
that's
we've
right.
acted accordingly. And our attorneys understood fully that we pay them based on what we raised specifically for that. Now, the other thing you'll find out about Count My Vote,
when they
disagree with you, they will malign you just like Kirk just did to the party.
Okay, let me just say, so party chairman Craig Frank in the Utah County mm-hmm. chapter of the party has apparently authorized the use of party resources like lists and manpower and campaign materials to defeat candidates who used the signature gathering process to get on the ballot. Do you support what's going on there?
Well, I think that's a very obvious answer because in the state central committee, we chose not to do that at the state party. There are 29 county parties,
yeah.
and we had three counties.
So you don't agree
chosen.
With what's going on down there?
Well, I think it's premature because, you know, when you're going to make a significant change like that, you have to first make the case to our larger Republican body so that they can understand or, you know, weigh in on it. But under their rules, They've stated that they can do that. We took a decision at the state party. The governing body chose to just follow what we said we were going to do. We got an answer from the courts. The rules are set, and that's what we're going by for the 2016 cycle. We can change that moving forward. But for 2016, the Utah Republican Party, we are remaining neutral in any contested races.
That's James Evans, chairman of the Utah Republican Party, and Kirk Jowers, founder and board member of Count My Vote, the group aimed at changing the Utah caucus system. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our discussion or our debate between James Evans, the chairman of the Utah Republican Party, and Kirk Jowers, founder and board member of Count My Vote. Kirk Jowers, what do you do about the fact that really passionate people show up early? They go to conventions. Like I said in that introduction, you got to hand it to them. They're the ones that get engaged in that process. And that there's this contention that the rest of the people who don't do that are apathetic. They don't, and then they get the leaders they deserve.
I give everyone who votes and participates all the credit. They deserve it. And delegates do put in a lot of time. My wife has been a delegate the last three times. My son was a delegate before he left for a couple of years. I've never missed a neighborhood meeting. It's got its virtues, and I think the reason why every other state has moved from Utah's the only state that has gotten more restrictive from 1896. We're the only state that has one path to the ballot. So whatever James says about 20 people or whatever, the goal is, and what SB 54 accomplished, is more participation. Now you can have the opportunity to go through the caucus convention system with all of its virtues and some of its flaws, and you can emerge as a candidate. You can also gather signatures, which forces you to talk to a lot more people. And at the end of the day, at the primary, people will get to choose between these different candidates. Some candidates, like Mike Lee, Governor Herbert, did it both ways. They took advantage of both opportunities to reach the most people. And so that's what I love about SB 54 is, at the end of the day, we're going to have more primaries, which allows more people to vote and to participate. And under the old system, as your example pointed out, it may well be that the people would have chosen Mike Lee over Bob Bennett in the primary, and that's great. And they may have chosen John Huntsman over Olene Walker. The frustration that the people in Utah felt and that the polls clearly showed was that they didn't even get a chance to vote that way. They didn't get a chance to say, thank you, first female governor of Utah, but we'd like to go with Huntsman now. Or they wanted to keep her. It never happened. It happened at that point, only 3,100 delegates were able to keep her from even getting in front of the people.
James Evans, what do you think about the signature collection process? I mean, Kirk Jowers's idea that, hey, you have to talk to more people. You have to really marshal some forces and get out there.
Well, the reality is that they didn't talk to more people. They just paid companies to gather the signatures for them. So it doesn't end up with you talking to more people. There were a few exceptions in smaller races where the candidates did go out door to door. But by and large, well over 90%+ of the candidates just paid a firm to gather the signatures. So once again, we're back to the propaganda. Now, as far as signatures...
You wanted to respond to that before he moves on?
Sure. It was a mix. Most candidates, I would say probably close to that 90%, did both. But it is true somewhere between 80 and 90% actually did hire someone to help them gather those signatures, not unlike you pay a radio to get your voice out or whatever.
That's good. Go ahead. Yeah.
So as far as, just so you understand what the contention of the Utah Republican Party has been, whether you gather signatures, however you want to nominate your candidates, we've always said that we believe that that's a decision of that political party because we're a private organization.
Yeah.
What happened is that you had individuals who clearly the Republican Party most certainly is the majority party. And that's where they saw that the power lied as far as determining who the nominees are. And they wanted to disrupt that for their own purposes. That's what they've done. They were able to get the legislature to go along with it. And I can tell you many legislators did not appreciate the tactics and what happened. But at the end of the day, it is what it is. Now, what we have to do as a political party is make sure we remain focused on what we've always said we wanted to protect, and that is truth in advertising. If you hold yourself out as a registered Republican candidate, that you have some relationship with our platform and the principles. So if a voter is
That's like a test?
No, it's just you have to disclose. Here's our platform. You simply sign a disclosure stating, I believe, in 50% of the platform or 90%, whatever, because don't you think voters should have a right to know that? As a party—
Kirk Jarvis, you don't have a problem with that, do you?
Yes. When they do, like Utah County is, where you have to go through a questionnaire and sign your name in order to even get in front of people. Deidre Henderson, for example, a state senator, very conservative, who has been against Count My Vote, so she has not been a real ally in this one, but a good state senator. She refused to do this. She thought it was intrusive, and she thought the democratic process would allow her to get in front of people and let her constituents decide whether she was a big R Republican, a real Republican or not. So she refused to do it, and Chairman Frank refused to give her any of the normally provided party assets, like party lists and otherwise. So no, I don't think that a couple of party leaders should be able to require a litmus test, a signed statement of what they agree with. That's what to me, that's what and that is our difference. He thinks that makes for a better system that some party leaders can ensure solidarity or unity or whatever, loyalty to the party principles. And I feel like it's we the people, that Republicans and Democrats and others will go through this process. They'll listen to a debate on KUER and KSL and wherever else, and they'll hear them, they'll look at their opinion pages, and then ultimately they'll make a vote. And you know, you can say that you have to do this, but if Mike Lee or Ted Cruz were to run as a Democratic candidate in Massachusetts, they probably wouldn't fare very well because they would say their principles and the Democrats in Massachusetts would figure out they're not for us. My guess is Elizabeth Warren would not get elected to office as a Republican here in Utah, and that's because voters are not as dumb as some people think they are. They're very smart, and they pay attention, and they'll choose the person they feel best represents their position.
Respond to that.
We absolutely agree that voters are very smart, but I must correct a couple, once again, misrepresentations. It's not a few party leaders that decide whether you've signed a disclosure or not. That's part of our bylaws for the state party. And what's wrong with disclosure? If you're going to be a Republican candidate, you can say, look, I agree with 100% of the platform, 50% of the platform. It's just simply truth in advertising. Then you go make your case. Simple as that. That's all we're asking. That's not adherence. That is simply disclosure. Kurt turned it into adherence. That's not the case.
It was adherence, though. Tell me how it was not adherence with Deidre Henderson in Utah County. If you can explain that, then I will bow to you and say you're right.
I'm talking about the Utah Republican Party, in which I chair. There are 29 county parties. There are some differences throughout the counties. And
so you're going back to the idea you don't really have control over Craig Frank's
Well, I don't have control because they're separate. Yeah, they're separate entities. Yeah. But ultimately, through all of these processes, we'll get to some accommodation where all of these issues will be sorted through.
So what would happen if a state candidate refused to sign that? They said, look, I'm going to be open. You can go look on my website and tell me if I'm a 20% Republican or a 50% or 100%.
Yeah.
What would you do to that candidate? Would you provide all the is it meaningless
simple.
if they don't do it or
no.
Is it meaningful? If it's meaningful, how so?
Prior to Count My Vote, the remedy was that we would just announce to the delegates that Kirk Jarvis refused to sign the disclosure. Now it's a part of our membership requirement because that was one of the
That is adherence. I would not be a Republican if I refused to sign it.
The adherence is just simply disclosure. You can sign a disclosure and say, I refuse to answer, and here's my signature. That's your disclosure. That's the point I'm getting at. It has nothing to do with it here. It's simply disclosing your opinion about the platform. And for some reason, Kirk Gyrus has a problem with that. I don't know of any other organization where if you are a member of it, that you don't have some kind of relationship where you demonstrate something like, you know, you're going to pay dues, or you're going to say, this is okay, these are the governing principles. I'm going to go out and represent the banner. So I think the party members are saying, well, disclose to us where you stand. So, and then there was a point that we did miss, and that is that in the very beginning, Kirk Gyrus made an assertion that somehow the caucus convention system had something to do with voter turnout. And we studied that, and it's a very simple reason for voter turnout. You must have a competitive two-party system at a minimum to drive turnout higher. Now, I, as chair of the Utah Republican Party, am not going to advocate for a stronger Democratic Party. But we studied the
so you both the disagree party, on what it is the that's one causing low voter turnout.
Yeah, but the one-party dominant states, we rank in the top tier. Like, for instance, Hawaii is overwhelmingly Democrat. They have a primary system, but they rank at the bottom in voter turnout. So it's not caucus. It's not primary. It really has everything to do with whether you have a competitive two-party process.
Quick response to that. Do you want to say anything more to that point?
Yeah, just quickly. We do absolutely disagree on that. I believe our caucus convention system is exhibit one of our Democratic malaise, that we are consistently by George Washington and Harvard and things that are published. He cites things that aren't published and their own independent studies. But we are consistently not only in the bottom five, we're in the bottom 10% of states that are massively one party or the other. And so we don't fare well no matter how we look. We just are not voting. And we don't have primaries. And so we have fewer people fewer opportunities even to vote. That will change, and I'm grateful for it this year and then 2018 and beyond.
James Evans, let me ask you, how far do you want – I mean, I know you're going to appeal this decision to the Tenth Circuit Court.
No, that's not true.
No, it's not true.
No. What we voted in a state central committee to do was to put together the process for an appeal to see what the cost would be, our likelihood of success, and then at our next state central committee meeting
is
where we'll
later.
Have the debate and determination.
Is it true you've spent some $200,000 so far in legal fees on this?
We haven't spent it, but the attorneys have billed that. But once again, the understanding with our attorneys are we pay you what we raise. So – and that's very clear with our attorneys. We pay you what we raise specifically for the legal challenge. So if someone contributes money to the Utah Republican Party, it goes to the Utah Republican Party. If they contribute money specifically for the legal challenge, that's where it goes.
So you'll do this privately. You won't look for state money to compensate if you do win. You'll keep this private, as you said?
Yeah, actually, we did have another change. We voted that the check-a-buck money will go for the legal challenge. So those are monies that we get for check-a-buck will go to pay for not the future legal challenge, but any amounts that we're accountable for that we've agreed to with our attorneys.
Kirk Gyrus, you regret compromising on HB 54? I mean, you could have
SB 54.
What did I say?
SB 54.
Forgive me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you regret that?
No.
Making the compromise? I mean, some argue you could have gotten a lot more.
We could have. We could have. We certainly had the signatures, and according to all the polls, it would have been a blowout, 75-80% that wanted Count My Vote, more participation in Utah elections. We felt very comfortable with SB 54. From the start, I was talking to Republican and Democratic Party chairs. It was always about the entire system, never about just Republicans. And so we always wanted it to be a team effort. And when the legislators came to us, we initially said, no, we're there. Why would we do it now? But they came up with a good bill, a bill that did preserve the caucus convention system, which was what I had written about for the first 4 years of this is, you know, let's keep what we've got, but let's improve it. There are ways that we can get more people involved. You know, look, if the Utah Republican Party is not going to honor a bill signed by a supermajority of their legislators and by their governor that's supported by a supermajority of Republican registered voting Republicans, I don't think they would have honored, our ballot initiative that would have won. And so we'd have probably gone through this as well, and it would have been just what happened here. He would have lost in the federal court and Utah Supreme Court, and we'd be right here. So I think we're at the same place, and there are just many ways to more participation, apparently.
When do you and the committee decide that you've lost and you're just going to concede?
Well,
count my vote.
There are legal options and there are political options.
Right.
And ironically, we have more political options than we've had in the past, because I think even our elected officials have come to recognize the resolve of the Utah Republican Party in one simple case. And that is that no special interests, no elected officials are going to just simply impose on a private organization, how about this? How about we sit down and we say, okay, these are our concerns. We've said them over and over and over again, but no one special interest is going to drive the Utah Republican Party. It's just not going to happen. And while Kurt Jowers can say right now that we have lost, this is a much longer term for, I think, the political health of this state, because I cannot
underestimate. So how far do you go? How long do you go?
We go as long as it takes.
Yeah.
And I cannot overstate enough the damaging effect of massive amounts of money that will be introduced into our election system when you have less than 20 people who will then be deciding who gets that money. And you're talking about corruption. You're talking about undue influence. That is just what I think is troubling a lot of just everyday Utahns. Yes, if you ask voters, do you want more say in your candidates and more control? Absolutely, they're going to say yes. But if you ask those same voters, do you want a system by which less than 20 people will pre-select your candidates and then you have to then choose amongst who's been pre-selected? They're going to reject that.
Okay. We're essentially out of time. Quick response. If you want to have a final word there, I'll give it to you, Kirk Jones.
I think the final word is Utah is looking ahead to better days. It's going to be more participation. People will start getting flyers. That used to be only the few delegates that ever got any attention. Now all Utahns will get that attention. I think it'll be more representative of how Utahns feel. And you'll have primary elections. You'll get to go punch the ballot, and that's a great honor. It's something our country's fought for, and so it's only going to get better.
Okay, gentlemen, thank you very much for being
Thanks
with
for
us.
Having me.
James Evans, chairman of the Utah's Republican Party, Kirk Jowers, founder and board member of Count My Vote. Thanks very much. We'll take a break. When we get back, a conversation with Thomas Mann and Norm Orenstein. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Joining us now on the program is Thomas Mann of UC Berkeley's Institute of Governmental Studies and Norman Orenstein of the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C. They've just released a new edition of their book. It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. In 2012, they first wrote the book, and they said that conditions had deteriorated at such a startling rate in the American political system that they needed to write this comprehensive and pointed critique. And their book was their attempt to describe what they say is exactly wrong with American democracy. We had them on the program to talk about it. And so we're going to try to follow up with Thomas Mann and Norm Orenstein. And gentlemen, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Great to be back.
Happy
you,
to be with you.
Well, we kind of got in the weeds in that earlier conversation. I wanted to sort of get to the broader question of just how we were talking about the particulars of this Count My Vote proposal, and that seemed to be the essence of the dispute. What I was trying to do was get to that bigger question of whether how much extreme party members are participating and influencing the process. So I'm hoping to sort of get back to that. But let me ask you first. In 2012, you thought it couldn't get any worse. You said that the political culture had passed a critical point. And it seemed then, when we were talking, that something had to give. But you've said it's even worse now. Could you just give us a sense of where you think we are now?
Well, what I would say, Doug, is that a lot of the trends that we pointed out back in 2012, instead of being ameliorated to some considerable degree, ameliorated by the re-election of Barack Obama, remember when Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell said, my number one goal is to make Barack Obama a one-term president. After he got reelected, I said, well, if his number one goal is to make him a two-term president, mission accomplished, and he's not going to be a three-term president, so maybe we can get some policy movement in important areas. and almost nothing has happened. And now, you know, all we need to do is look at what happened through the Republican primary campaign for president, the complete collapse of an establishment being able to dictate a nominee, a contest that came down to Donald Trump and Ted Cruz, a party that is nationally careening out of control. And so, you know, we put on the cover of this one, we crossed out looks, and it's now it's even worse than it was. And, you know, the next one, if we had to do it, might be run for your lives.
Well, you said that this unworkable system, as you said just then, has created these forces that brought Donald Trump to where he is now. And you've talked about, but I think it was something like between 60% and 70% of Republican voters have gone for outsiders, have gone for anti-establishment candidates, which reveals what? That they're seeing what you're seeing and they're sick of it.
There's many things to be unhappy about in the country with economic difficulties that we've gone through, with the extraordinary changes in the economy and in the society. It's been disruptive to people. But what has really stirred up folks on the Republican side of the aisle is has been the rhetoric coming from the Republican Party leadership of how awful Congress is, how corrupt it is, how corrupt the president is. We have seen a denigration of American government, of Congress, of the other party, in which no legitimacy is extended to the other side. And it has led to a unified party opposition, which has even after Republicans took control of Congress, which has frustrated their base, and now they've turned on their own leadership. So there's a surly group of Republican voters out there, not all Republicans, but people who've actually become accustomed to the Donald Trump's way of talking. They heard it first from Newt Gingrich and from a whole host of Republican leaders coming out of Washington and out of various state capitals.
So does that mean then that this is no longer the discontent based on ideology, that, you know, it used to be states' rights and free trade and anti-abortion and a lot of the cultural issues, you know, response to gay rights, those kinds of things. But it seems it's less that now and more just some reflection of dissatisfaction with what's going on or not going on in government. Is that fair to say?
It's very much identities now rather than strong sort of clearly thought out ideological differences. The fact that Bob Bennett, who was a conservative but thought the job of being a senator was to try to write law, and that meant talking with your own party members and other party members. It meant a conservative Republican governor like Governor Herbert did what he thought was the right thing for the state, and if that entailed at times raising taxes, so be it. But now it's become something else about identity and absolute opposition and anger and who's a real American. And that's what's really poisoned our politics.
But, you know, let me add that we always get a kind of populism when you have tough economic times. Yeah. It's a very angry populism right now. We did see it on both sides. On the Democratic side, it did not result in a backlash against the party and the establishment so much, and a fairly minor adjustment in terms of policy positions. But a different thing on the Republican side. And part of it is the immigration issue became a kind of surrogate for a much broader level of unease among white working class voters over the changes taking place in the society, including the vast expansion in numbers that will continue for some time of minorities in the United States. But there's another element to this as well. You know, populism brings with it a protectionism, some level of isolationism, and some nativism. Donald Trump has taken a set of positions that blow up the orthodoxy of the Republican Party in a big way. Support for Social Security and Medicare, for expanding, not dramatically changing the way they work. Opposition to trade in a fashion that really cuts them to the core. even though his tax plan offers a huge break for the rich, he criticized it. He's criticized the new post-Citizens United regimen of campaign finance. And the reality is that for a whole lot of Republican voters, those positions, opposition to trade, support for Social Security and Medicare, are what they believe in. It was the leaders who in many ways were out of step with their own constituents and used a combination of dog whistles and tribalism to keep people in line. And now it's going to be very hard for them to figure out what their core ideology is going to be when they're separated from a good share of their own voters.
One of the central points you've made in the book is that there are these two problems. And one of them is that polarization is asymmetric. That is, that this was more a Republican thing than a Democrat thing. And I'm wondering, in any way, has Bernie Sanders' seeming popularity changed the way you see that? That there is more discontent within Democrats? Or does that idea of asymmetry still hold in your minds?
Our feeling is that the sort of major arguments of the book have been upheld yeah. by the actions or inactions of Congress since we originally published it, and by the course of this presidential nomination stage. It's absolutely true there is left-wing populist sentiment within the Democratic Party and the community, but the way in which it surfaced, it's really been a difference of degree, not of kind. You know, Bernie wants, universal health care. Well, that's an aspiration of Obama and Clinton, and there's no way you're going to legislate that in a one-time operation. The same is true of affordability of college and minimum wage and the rest. So I think Bernie Sanders was able to attract especially younger voters coming in and just seeing things to be unhappy with. But in the end, you didn't see a huge division of the sort we saw. And bottom line is that the party itself came together, and Hillary Clinton actually won those big primary elections yeah. where yeah. core Democratic constituencies are voting, and demonstrated there is no such gap between, in this case, the winning Democratic nominee and the Democratic rank and file, as Norm has demonstrated there is on the Republican side.
When we talked before, and we'll put a link, in fact, to that earlier conversation, because we don't have time to go into some of the structural issues that you mm-hmm. deal with. It's fascinating, and I'm expecting, as you just said, Thomas Mann, that most of those things have been confirmed. The conversation we had about fixing the system, some of this is about changing, as you've said, the political culture. One of the things we talked about was restoring public shame, recreating a public square. We're among those. Can I ask you about public shame, restoring public shame? Where does that sit in the Donald Trump era?
All you have to do is look at Donald Trump yeah. and look at the dilemma that Republican leaders now have. Those who have indicated their support for him, but find almost every day they have to try to get some distance from an inflammatory comment yeah. that he's made. Nowhere is that more true than with Paul Ryan.
Right.
But what's also happened is that because Trump has used a coarse language on the campaign trail that we haven't seen from a candidate before. We had that famous seven words that you can't use on the airwaves. George Carlin came up with, and I think Trump is at four of the seven, and we'll see how much further he gets. But he's also encouraged an atmosphere, I think. If you look at what people are saying at his rallies, the language that they're using vocally, the things that they have on their T-shirts mm-hmm. that we wouldn't have expected from a conservative Republican audience in the past, it just shows that we're defining deviancy down even further in a way that, to use the term that Daniel Patrick Moynihan had come up with. And that's not a very good thing for not just our political culture, but our larger culture.
But did that make you rethink this idea of restoring public shame? Because you must have thought over the past couple of weeks, this is pretty shameful. Why aren't people reacting in more outraged ways?
We called for a restoration, but that doesn't mean it's going to happen.
Right, right.
But the really interesting question is, will Trump go so far with this and then be rejected so decisively that a lesson begins to be taken from this experience and you begin to turn it around a little bit? The one thing I'm getting a little encouragement from is that a mainstream media, which has protected itself from charges of political bias by insisting on equivalence, on balance, when there's nothing balanced or equivalent about it, has been faced with the reality to that of treating the two candidacies in the same way and not at the moment indicating what's true and what isn't true. And I think maybe we're going to begin to free them from the clutches of the professional norms that have worsened the problem. But as Norm says, it can always get worse before it gets better.
So are you seeing, let me ask you both finally, 2016 is a pretty big test in the sense that if voters reject the rhetoric of Donald Trump and that has a down ballot effect on the Republican Party, which some people expect it will, and I'm guessing you both do on some level, will that finally cause a kind of rethinking in the Republican Party?
You know, I would say that may happen. And I will say one of the things that I find most encouraging is happening in Utah. It's not only Mitt Romney taking a very strong and I think very principled stand early on, no equivocation. It's also in the heartbreakingly beautiful speech that your lieutenant governor gave at the vigil for Orlando the other day.
Yeah.
That was an extraordinary admission from somebody that you wouldn't have expected necessarily to do it. These are models for behavior, I think, drawing lines about what's not acceptable, but also indicating a level of civility and a rethinking of fundamentals. It would be awfully nice to see that become a model that others pick up on in the nation.
Thomas Mann, final thought?
I think Norm put it well. This is a broad test of the capacity of Americans as a collective community to determine whether the basic shape of democratic governance will continue or not. This is the Trump candidacy and the recent developments within the Republican Party are the biggest threats to our democracy, at least since the Civil War. And I can't imagine an election with higher stakes or greater consequences.
It's Thomas Mann of UC Berkeley's Institute of Governmental Studies. Norm Ornstein, also, of course, with us with the American Enterprise Institute. Gentlemen, thanks for doing that for us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Doug.
Thank you.
And let me mention, they've just released a new edition of their book, which you should read. It's called It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.